You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, these days, more investors are getting into day trading to take advantage of market downturns instead of watching helplessly from the sidelines. The problem? Day trading can be risky, and trading the downside can be confusing. But binary options on Nadex let you day trade with risk protection built in. You decide your maximum risk and reward, and you can never lose more. And trading downturns is just as easy as trading rallies. Try day trading for yourself on the first and largest American binary options exchange. Trade stock indexes, commodities, forex, even economic numbers. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. That's Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast.
Well, it was my New Year's resolution to lose 15 pounds this year. I've only got 25 pounds to go. I read recently, Kim Jong-un is considering outlawing sarcasm in North Korea. I wonder if he proposed that to his team and one of his generals said, oh yeah, that'll work. Tennis is weird. If you don't have any points, you have to say love. You don't say it like that with other things, like your checking account. Oh, no! I've got love!
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a trailer for comedian Brian Regan's new Netflix stand-up special, Nunchucks and Flamethrowers. Brian Regan is widely respected by comics from Jerry Seinfeld to Marc Maron as one of the hardest-working comedians in the business, with an appeal that crosses generations and gender lines, and a knack for finding fresh, hilarious takes on topics that might seem played out to lesser comedians, all without swearing or politicizing or talking about sex. Though he says being labeled as a quote-unquote clean comic is a double-edged sword, it's also a source of pride for a comic who works meticulously on his craft and routinely fills some of America's largest concert venues, including Radio City Music Hall. Now Brian Regan's new stand-up special, Nunchucks and Flamethrowers, comes out on Netflix Tuesday, November 21st. And today Brian joins me on the podcast to talk about his very first act, the worst gig he ever had, and his comedic influences, including his dad, the family cut-up. He shares why he doesn't want to see his audience, why he never plays the town he lives in, and the incredibly weird audition that got him on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Plus, Brian has a bone to pick with tennis and offers his sage advice for Middle East peace. Coming up with comedian Brian Regan in just a moment. I'm joined today by comedian Brian Regan, who is coming out with a new Netflix comedy special November 21st called Nunchucks and Flamethrowers. Brian, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, I watched the Netflix special last night, and I just have to say how happy I was to see you take on tennis and how they score the points on tennis, because I grew up in a tennis family. They were all about tennis, and I could never make sense of how they keep the score. It's the craziest, most illogical thing.
I agree completely. I never understood it. And there must be some history to it, why they do 15 and 30 and 40.
Yeah.
But I've always found it absurd.
Instead of just 1, 2, 3.
One, two, three, four. I could never wrap my head around why that wasn't the scoring system.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4. 15, 30, even the ratios. Why 15 and then 30 and then 10 more to 40? Like, why is the ratio any different? It just completely blows my mind.
I've asked a million times. I don't think anyone – there has to be some kind of story behind that, but I've never gotten any kind of explanation behind
it. I'm afraid to look it up because then that ruins the comedy.
Yeah.
It's like when people come up after shows and they, like, solve one of your comedic problems, and then you go, yeah, but I'd rather have the – I'd rather have the 3 minutes of comedy than to know the solution and have nothing to talk about.
Yeah, you got to come up with another 5 minutes then.
That's right. That's why I don't read. That's why I don't read and why I don't pursue any knowledge.
You have Wikipedia blocked on your phone?
Everything is blocked because if I get the actual information, then I have nothing to talk about.
Well, 2 years ago, you did a Comedy Central special from Radio City Music Hall, 100% live. Yes. I noticed you didn't do that with this new special.
No.
Any lessons learned there from that experience?
Well, I'm glad I did a live special in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do one. I wanted to take the challenge on. But one is enough for this lifetime. It's a very intense experience because you don't want to make any mistakes. And, you know, to me, I'm more interested in the comedy, but I found that of other people were like more interested to see if you went off the rails somehow. You know what I mean? It's like some people when they go to a NASCAR race, they want to see wrecks.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I would rather if I was a NASCAR driver, you'd like to see me cross the finish line first. So it's the same with comedy. It's like I would prefer that you just want to see a good comedy show than see me have some type of public meltdown.
Yeah, there's a little bit of Schadenfreude there.
Yes.
Probably. Well, when you tape a special like this new one, do you do it over the course of multiple performances and edit it together? Can you go back and correct yourself if you blub a line or something?
Yes. I guess every special is done differently. A rule of thumb is oftentimes specials are shot twice, maybe two shows on the same night. Huh. You know, you wear the same clothes, obviously, or else you create a disaster for the editor.
A continuity problem.
Yes. But I did three shows. I did one on Friday and two on Saturday. Chose one as the master. And then if there was a particular joke or something from another show that went better, I went and grabbed that. But basically one of the shows was a master.
Do you ever do something where you have two or three performances and just the audience isn't there with you? And you got to do another one or something.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had it for a special yet. Yeah. Usually I've been fortunate that if I'm shooting, you know, the audiences have been good. But I certainly have had shows in my career where audiences were confused as to what I was doing. They probably didn't even know I was a comedian. You know, I had a guy one time ask me after a show. I it was some corporate show.
Oh,
and I went on stage.
I
don't even know if it was a corporate show. It was like this show, like for a bunch of men at a country club. You know, it was like a guy's night, but older men.
Like a retirement party or something?
I don't even. It was like this fancy, fancy country club, and it was all guys, and they were like smoking cigars and drinking cognac and stuff. And I work clean, you know what I mean? But like a bunch of guys together, they want it maybe a little edgier than what I do. And they were very polite. You know, no one heckled. All I saw was smoke rings in the air.
Yeah.
And it was very they were very polite and quiet. And I got off stage and a guy handed me a glass of scotch on the rocks and said, he said, I thought you might want this. And I was like, you are correct. You are correct. I do want. I had never drank scotch in my life, but at that point, I wanted a scotch. I said, yes, I would like that. And he said, I'm just curious, what do you do for a living? That's what he asked.
Oh, really?
With all seriousness. You know, he must have thought I was just like playing around trying to do this comedy thing.
Yeah.
He goes, "What do you, you know?" He was like, "What do you really do?" and it was weird to me that does he think I bomb like that like every night? You know what I mean? It was so bizarre.
I always hear from comics that the corporate gigs are always the worst because, you know, they're not there to see you. They're there to
Correct.
Get an award or a bonus or something. And
Correct.
You're just a distraction to them.
Yeah, it's a different animal than mm-hmm. a comedy show where people are there specifically to see comedy or sometimes I'm fortunate enough where they're even there to see me specifically
yeah.
in a comedy show. But a corporate gig is a different animal because they're assembled for another reason. And you also have the corporate hierarchy in place. So
uh-huh. How
people
does that
laugh
affect you?
Up.
Oh, yeah? They
is
wait
the
to
boss
see if the
laughing?
Boss is laughing. Really?
If the boss is not laughing, they don't want to be caught laughing. They don't want to be approving something that the yeah. boss isn't approving.
Yeah.
And I'm not a smart enough performer to find out, well, who's the boss? And let me get on this guy's side. You know,
yeah,
I just do my
show. That would make
show.
Your job a lot easier if you just have to play to one person.
Right. Just play to the top dog, and then everybody else, by default, has to laugh.
Yeah. Well, you're known for doing theater shows instead of comedy clubs. Hell, the last place you played was Radio City Music Hall in the last special. Do you like performing in these big venues? Because a lot of comics tell me that, you know, they do it for the money, but a big theater is not the best environment for stand-up sometimes.
It depends on the venue. Mm-hmm. I mean, some theaters are amazing, even for comedy. Some theaters are designed maybe more for music. Radio City Music Hall is a beautiful, iconic venue.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a thrill to be able to perform there. But it's not a great comedy room.
It's you not know, an intimate venue.
It's not intimate at all. It's huge and yeah. cavernous and huge ceilings, and there are balconies, but they're way in the back.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So laughs you want in as tight an atmosphere as possible, so they're bouncing around. And so when it's a wide-open space, it's not as good for comedy. So mm-hmm. even though I loved performing there, it's not necessarily a good comedy room.
Yeah, somewhere I read that you like to keep the house lights down when you're performing in a theater, maybe just be able to see the first three rows. Is that your way of kind of recreating that more intimate nightclub environment?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It's weird for me to see everybody. You know, I'm playing for laughs. I'm playing for sound.
Yeah.
I'm not playing for a visual. And yeah. I'm not looking to visually see people laugh.
Yeah.
But I want to see some humanity, you know, I do want to see at least a row or two of people because I've done shows where the lights are so bright that
yeah.
you literally see no one.
Yeah, it's like performing for a two-way mirror or something.
It's so strange. Yeah. I opened for Jerry Seinfeld one time and it was like the first time I was experiencing theaters and we performed in this venue and I walked out and it struck me that I could not see a soul. I could not see another human being. And then I did my show, and fortunately it went fine. I mean, I'm hearing laughs. I'm hearing things. But it was so bizarre to go, I'm not seeing another human being. And I left the stage, and we left that night, and I'm like, what was that all about? You know, it could have been a big,
yeah.
big practical joke where somebody just – put speakers out there
yeah,
of an audience laughing, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, most comedians work their whole lives and never get to the point where they're touring in these big theater shows. And even when they do, it's usually because, you know, they have some kind of big name recognition from a sitcom or they're doing a lot of movies. You have mostly, up until recently, have stuck to just stand up and plugging away. And I guess, what, you through word of mouth over the years?
Yes. I'm very proud of the fact that I have a little bit of a following. I mean, enough to be able to play these nice
Pretty
venues.
Big, I'd say.
And but I have this weird, I never know whether you say niche or niche. Is that one of those words you can say either way?
I think so.
All right. Well, I have
How fancy do you want to be? That's the question.
I don't want to be that fancy.
Okay.
I want to do
niche.
The unfancy niche. Version of it. I'll say niche. Yeah. I think niche is probably fancier. I have this weird niche that I have a following, but not because of something other than comedy. Because a
yeah.
lot of comedians who have a following are also on a sitcom, or they also have done a podcast, or they have something else that they're known for. I don't have anything else that I'm known for. So if people are coming out to see me, it has to be because they like my comedy, because there would be no other way they would know me.
So it's kind of cool. A lot of pressure, though, to put on your act, I
guess. I like it.
Yeah.
I like
it. You
like it?
Yeah. Now, who were some of the early comedic influences on you growing up?
Some comedians who are no longer with us. Richard Pryor, George Carlin. I watched a Richard Pryor special about 4 or 5 years ago. And he was so good at what he did that it literally brought tears to my eyes, because I felt like in an emotional way. I mean, not in a comedic way, because I was like watching the art form that I like to try to do done in a masterful way. You know, I felt like I was watching maybe somebody who's just trying to get into painting, you get to watch Rembrandt paint or something. And I'm like, wow, comedy can be beautiful.
Yeah.
And he was so good at it. So anyway, I'm a Richard Pryor fan, George Carlin fan, Jerry Seinfeld, big fan of Jerry Seinfeld. And then there are people out there today. Seinfeld, of course, is still performing.
Yeah.
Maria Bamford. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
She's great. Yeah.
She's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know,
hilarious.
And she has her own, I'll use Nietzsche for her. you know, she does something that nobody else does. She has these quirky characters, and she's just, I love that comedy can be done in a variety of ways. And when someone can hit on a unique approach like Maria Bamford has been able to do, I love to experience that.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned George Carlin and Pryor, because, you know, those are all bluer than blue comics in their day. And you have this label of a clean comic, which, you know, it sounds like you probably chafe at that label, do you?
It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Clearly, there are many people out there who like clean things, whether it's comedy. You know, they just prefer what they consider a wholesome type of entertainment. Mm-hmm. Maybe they have families. You don't even have to have a family. You could just be an older person who prefers a clean type of approach to entertainment. And I respect that. But I think people often miss the point as to why I do it.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it for wholesome reasons. I do it for the comedic challenge. You know, I want to see how hard I can get somebody laughing without hitting certain buttons. And people, I feel, will laugh disproportionately at the F word or disproportionately at a sexual reference, because added to the whole atmosphere is this, oh, I can't believe he's saying that.
Yeah.
Or I can't believe she's saying that, you know, like it's the shocking titillation shock factor. But there are comedians out there who work blue or dirty who I think are great.
Sure.
It depends on whether it's organic to your message.
Yeah. And
or
they don't
if you're
use
hitting
it as
buttons.
A crutch, I guess.
Exactly. If you're pushing buttons for the sake of pushing buttons, like, oh, I know if I say this outrageous thing, I'll get a reaction. That's not as entertaining to me as someone who is talking about outrageous things, because it's part of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when Richard Pryor talked about serious stuff in his life, it's because of who he was. So it was more organic, and therefore I give it more of a green light.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I had Gilbert Gottfried, of all people, on a few weeks ago talking about how he used to only work clean, and he used to sort of look down on comics who worked blue a lot of times, because he would always see sitcoms, some comedian he knew would be on there, and they would say some line like, I ate a sandwich, and it would just bomb. And after a while, he started to realize in his head, I think, that probably what happened was some casting director saw this guy in a club, and he said, and I'd like a effing sandwich, and it just killed and got a big laugh. But then once they took the F-bomb out of it and put it on network television, it lost all of its sizzle.
Yes, yes. It's a tricky thing as to, you know, to try to assess whether the word is getting the laugh or mm-hmm. whether the idea is getting the laugh. And sometimes the word is helping a tone, like the tone of what you're talking about, and therefore it can still be organic, you know. To me, it's fascinating, you know, how much of a crutch it is or, you know. But I like to do it the way that I do it, but I'm careful not to go so far as to say everyone should do it the way I do it. I like that there are blue comedians. I like that there are dirty comedians. I like that there are political comedians. I like that there are prop comics. Everybody should be approaching it from the perspective that works for them.
Yeah. I think that probably audiences sometimes have trouble accepting that there are a lot of different varieties of comedy out there.
Yes. Yeah. A weird compliment for me is when someone comes up after a show and instead of just saying, hey, wow, I really enjoyed your show, they kind of like lean in like, I'm glad you're not like them.
Interesting.
You don't know, it's an us against them, and them in their mind is dirty comedians.
That's interesting. They kind of pit you against you know, the comedians who don't work clean. That's
interesting. And I feel like,
but
saying,
you don't feel that way.
I like them.
I
like what they do as well as what I do. You know what I mean? So you might only like what I do, and that's fine for you, but you know, it's weird picking sides.
Yeah. What are you only supposed to like, yourself and Jim Gaffigan?
And I love Jim Gaffigan.
Yeah. You get that comparison a lot.
Oh, yeah.
He probably does, too.
Yes. I think that of all the comedians, I get compared to I'm grouped together with him probably more than anybody else because he also works clean and he also has a very observational style. You know, I like the way he can just, you know, pick some subject and go at it for 5 minutes. You know, I like to do that occasionally as well.
Yeah. Do you ever feel that you've been defined or pigeonholed and maybe you want to break free of certain things that you're known for, whether it's the physical comedy that you do, the moving around, the crouching, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I have. I've purposefully gone the long route with my comedy because I've always been resistant to be a caricature of myself, you know?
Yeah.
I think oftentimes if an entertainer or a comedian specifically starts to be defined a certain way, they naturally would think, oh, this is something that's working for me. I should go towards this and let this be my thing. I've always resisted that. It's like as soon as I feel like I'm being defined a certain way, I go away from that, you know, like you say, the physicality I used to crouch over and like, you know, and when I started, when people would say, well, this is what Brian Regan does, I'm like, well, that's maybe part of it. That's not all I do. So I would start standing erect on stage. and then I also used to do a lot of feeling dumb fantasies, you know, feeling socially awkward and feeling inadequate. Yeah. And then when I felt like people were saying, well, that's Brian Regan's go-to or shtick or whatever, not in a bad way, but I thought, all right, I'm going to start writing anger fantasies, you know? And so I include a lot of those in my show. So I wanted to make it hard for people to define me, which is probably lessened the ability for me to make it big.
Yeah. Oh, you think so?
Oh,
that's
interesting. Yeah.
Now, did you come from a funny family growing up? I know that you had a big family.
Yes. My mom and dad have 8 kids. My father just passed away about 4 or 5 months ago. He was 90. He would have celebrated his 91st birthday, November 11th. He was very funny, very dry sense of humor, yet silly. He liked comeuppance kind of comedy. He liked when somebody who was full of himself got a stick poked at him.
Yeah.
You know? He liked when things were made right, you know, even through comedy. But I've always liked that he was a caring person, and he liked when when pompous people were neutralized through humor, you know?
Yeah.
And my mom is a very smart woman. She's still alive. She's also 90. She had a master's in English, yet she has a very goofy sense of humor. She used to love Andy Kaufman when we were young.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Who's just silly, you know? And to have somebody who, like, you would never beat my mom in Jeopardy ever, yet she liked this outlandish goofball kind of humor.
Yeah.
So I think having both of them in my life, I'm sure, helped form who I am as a comedian.
Yeah.
And then all my brothers and sisters are also funny as well in their own ways.
Yeah. Don't you have a brother who's also a comedian?
My brother Dennis. Yeah. Very funny stand-up. Mm-hmm. We work together occasionally. He did a handful of Lettermans. He did The Tonight Show a couple of times. He wrote for the King of Queens TV show when it was on.
Yeah.
A very good writer, very, very funny guy.
I read somewhere that you went to college to be an accountant.
Yes.
And you ended up dropping out to go into comedy. Well, what inspired you to do that? I mean, talk about a radical career shift.
I went to Heidelberg College in Tiffin, Ohio. It is now called Heidelberg University. I say my college graduated before I did. Why they are a university now as opposed to a college, I couldn't tell you. But I liked college. I liked the word college. I liked how quaint that felt.
Yeah,
anyway.
It's warm and fuzzy.
Yeah. And I went there to just – I had to choose something. So I chose the economic – I was an economics major thinking I would be an accountant.
Uh-huh.
I played football in high school and in college. After some accounting classes, I talked to my – college football coach, and I said, "Hey, man, I'm disillusioned here. I love the I love the football, but I don't, I don't like my major." He's the one that suggested the Communication Theater Arts Department.
Okay,
and so I switched majors, and it was in that world that I took speech classes and acting classes, and that's when I started gravitating towards what I do now.
When did you first try out your comedy act? When did you first do an open mic? What year would that have been?
Well, there are a number of firsts. Okay. You know, I mean, there was the first in a comedy club, which took place a number of years after I decided I wanted to do it. But when I was in college and decided I wanted to do it, I know now, but I wasn't able to discern at the time. There's a difference between emceeing something and being funny and saying you're a comedian. That's a strong line.
Huh.
That's a strong line in the sand. So when I was in college, I used to MC activities.
Mm-hmm.
They would say, "Hey, would you introduce the basketball team?" They wanted to have a game show in my dorm and asked if I would host it.
Really?
And so I was able to be funny under those circumstances. But then when I said, "I'm doing a stand-up comedy show at the college bar," now it's like, I'm going to be funny. It's not like I'm going to host something and I can happen to be funny.
Yeah. You're setting
expectations. You're saying I'm going to be funny.
Yeah.
That's a whole different ball game from doing something else and happening to be funny. So my friends and professors and stuff, they come out to this Brian Regan's Going to Be Funny show. And I'm on stage saying things like, "So I was on a bus today." And they were like, "No, you weren't." And I'm like, "Well, no, I know I wasn't really, but just pretend I was on a bus." And they're like, "It's hard for us to make that mental leap. We were with you this morning, and you were nowhere near a bus." And I remember thinking, this is so strange.
Does it bother you when you have friends or family in the audience?
I don't want to see them. I don't want them in – you mentioned those first
few
rows.
They can be there, but you don't want to see them.
I don't want them in the first few rows.
Okay.
Because not only do I not want to see them, I don't want them feeling like they have to laugh at everything I say. I would rather they be out in the middle
awkward.
Of the audience enjoying it or enjoying other people enjoying it.
You know?
I mean, I've had people who have seen me many times say that one of the things they like to do is watch other people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've seen me many times.
Oh, that's interesting. What was your first big break? Was that The Tonight Show?
There were a few breaks along the way.
Mm-hmm.
I always say that my first big break was At the comedy club where I started, I auditioned there 5 times, and on the 5th audition is when Joe Mullen, who ran the place, passed me, meaning okay. he gave me the yeah. green light.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the biggest night of my career to this day, because prior to that, I didn't know if I could do this comedy thing. And when he came up, I finally had an audition that went pretty well. And this guy came, Joe Mullen, I later came to know him, obviously, but I didn't know who he was. He came up to my table. I was sitting down. My heart was pounding because I'm like, wow, that went well. That went well in a comedy club on an audition night. And I sat down, had a Budweiser in front of me. Heart going, just like I can't even, you know, like, wow, this is what I want to do.
Yeah, you got
and
the
And it
high.
Went well. And I'm like, Joe Mullen walks up and says, and he was this short, feisty Irish guy. He's still around. I talked to him a few months ago. He said, hey, can I talk to you in the kitchen? And he introduced himself. He said, hey, I'm Joe Mullen. I run this place. Can I talk to you in the kitchen? And I had a feeling that this was a good sign. And I said, yeah, sure. And my heart just kept boom, boom, boom. And I had the tab in front of me for the beer. And he says, I'm taking care of this. And I was like, wow, I'm already getting paid. I already got a free beer. And so I go, he brings me into the kitchen. He says, I've been watching you, you know, over the last few weeks. I didn't know anybody was paying attention, you know. And I was like, okay. And he goes, you're a pretty funny guy. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, you've passed and you can consider yourself a local comedian. And it changed my life.
Yeah.
And that night, I tell wow. people think this is BS. This is not BS. That comedy club was in Fort Lauderdale. I was still living with my parents down in Miami, Florida. It was an hour drive. That night, I was driving home already like euphoric. And I saw my first shooting star of my life.
Oh, really?
A shooting star literally just like right like – and I was like, yeah. Could this be more surreal?
It wasn't the Budweiser?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then I crashed into a pole.
Well, it is Florida.
Yeah, right. So anyway, it was just a magical night mm-hmm. for me.
Now, you performed on The Tonight Show, I think, right before Johnny left. And then you performed on Letterman, I think, more than any other comedian. You know, guest bookers, I've heard, tended to pigeonhole comics as so-and-so is more of a Dave comic or so-and-so is a Johnny comic. Did you ever experience that? Or did you consider yourself more comfortable with a particular host or their audience maybe really got you better than others?
Well, I mean, I wasn't, you know, picky and choosy, you know, at first. You know, anybody yeah. that wanted me, I would be on.
Sure.
But when Johnny Carson was hosting The Tonight Show, that was the that was what every comedian wanted to do. Everybody yeah. wanted to be on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Now, goals, they're much more fractured. You know, there's different things people can go after. So that was my dream as well. And there, when I did The Tonight Show, there was talk in the air that he was going to be retiring soon.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, maybe I'll never be able to fulfill this dream. I had auditioned a few times and never was able to get on. So I auditioned about a year before he retired, and it didn't go well.
Really?
It went.
Why?
Well, I mean, it was okay, but it didn't go as well as other auditions had gone where they said no.
Okay.
So I thought, all right, well, this isn't going to happen. The next day, my manager called me and said, Jim McCauley, he was the guy who booked the comedians for The Tonight Show, mm-hmm. wants to see you in his office tomorrow. And I was like, wow. So I go to NBC. I mean, what a weird thing. And I'm driving my little rental car, and I'm like, hi, you know, at the gate. I'm here to see Jim McCauley. They said, yeah, there's a parking space for you over there. I'm like, I already have a parking space. No, of course, it was just for that meeting. But I go into his office, and he was an unusual person. You know, I only met him, I think, the one time, maybe the night I did the show. And And you're out in the waiting room of his office, and it's like, all right, Jim will see you now. So I go into his office, and I sit across from his desk, and he's like, hey, enjoyed your show the other night. I said, thank you very much. You know, appreciate it. And he goes, I forget what you did. Can you refresh my memory? And I'm like, this is bizarre. And I'm like, do I do the jokes? Do I just paraphrase? I said, well, my first joke was about saying U2 at the wrong times and feeling silly about it. And he's just staring at me. And now I'm thinking, does he not remember the bit? Do I do the bit? I said, you know, like when you're getting out of a cab and the driver goes, hey, have a nice flight. And you go, you too. And he just keeps staring at me like, no, yeah. Not a smirk. And he goes, and what was the joke after that? And now I'm thinking, he must have me mixed up with somebody else. So I did the next bit. And he goes, and what did you do after that? And what did you do after that? I feel like I'm bombing over this desk, you know, like I'm losing this career altering opportunity over this desk. And I finished the whole thing, and I said, well, that was the set. And he just looked at me, and he goes, yeah, I'd be willing to book you on the show based on that. And I was like, oh God, you could have given me an indication with a smirk somewhere along the way. And I said, well, I appreciate that. He goes, I'm not committing to it yet. I said, okay. He goes, I want to talk to your manager. And I said, okay, wonderful. And so I'm thinking, do I have it or not? Yeah, and he walked me out. He said, thanks for coming in today. And then I said, thank you very much for having me in. I really appreciate the opportunity of you talking to me. You know, you want to be vague. You don't want to say thank you for the show because I don't know if I have it.
Right.
And I leave the office and I go out to where the elevators are. And as I push the down button, and then he comes out and says, hey. And I'm like, yeah. He goes, how do you spell your name? And I'm thinking, this is so strange. I said, B-R-I-A-N-R-E-G-A-N. He goes, all right, I want to get it correct for the TV guide. And I'm like, oh, man. Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So he called my manager and said that I had the show. I was on the next week.
Yeah. Well, that's how it happened back then. You know, you get discovered, you're on the next week, and the next week you're getting sitcom offers. That was always the legend about The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to tell me that it turned out that he had Alzheimer's. Jim McCauley has Alzheimer's.
No, it was. Yeah. So anyway, it was. Pretty amazing.
Now, what is your process like when you're working on an act? Do you sit down and try to write jokes, or do you have to be out and about and get the inspiration from being out in the world?
I'm not good at writing. I'm not good at sitting down and trying to write. I just mm-hmm. I don't know how to do it. I've tried it. I remember somebody saying that, you know, a good exercise is to sit down at a keyboard and just write for an hour straight and just let stuff come out of you. And I tried it. And I was like, this is nothing but nonsense. So I just felt that doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
So I just go through my day the way I would normally go through my day. And then every once in a while, you notice something. How that happens, I don't know. I don't know how that happens.
Yeah.
But once you have it, then you can apply a craft to it. It's like, okay, I've got the idea for the bit. Now I can work on it.
Yeah, and you're known for finding fresh takes on subjects that might have seemed to have already been exhausted by other comedians, like flying or lines at Disneyland.
Yes.
And it's one of the reasons that so many comedians admire you, because you can work on a topic and explore it from all kinds of angles till you find something new. How often do you find yourself pondering and probing something that's been done before and just give up and say, yeah, everything's been done on that?
That's a good question. Well, the way I try to come up with a bit is not that way anyway.
Okay.
It isn't like I look at a subject and go, is there comedy there?
Okay.
I just find something that's funny, and then whatever the subject is, it happens to be the subject. Mm-hmm. So like the line at Disneyland thing happened to me. I was in line with my kids, and these people from behind us just got around and stepped right in front of us, and it happened again the same day on the next ride, and I thought, well, this must be a common, and I found myself getting angry inside, and so I thought this must be a common experience for people, and let me see if there's some comedy here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it happens to me first before I go, okay, Disney lines, where are the jokes? Okay. I can't do it.
You don't
way.
Think, is there anything new that I can mine off of this one particular subject? Okay. And I mentioned how many comedians praise you as the comedian's comedian and say you were an influence on them. Do you ever watch young comics today and see your influence or a joke that maybe built off of some bit you did in an early act? And I don't mean in an egotistical way or anything like that.
Yeah. worked with, you know, when I played comedy clubs, you know, sometimes it would just be the local comedians who were opening and middling and that sort of thing. Now that I'm playing the larger venues, I choose who's going to be who I'm performing with. But it used to be, you know, you would perform with some people and you go, oh, these are a couple of local people from this town. And sometimes I felt like, they might have been influenced by me with their style. I was, you know, talking about the crouching over thing and the feeling stupid stuff. And I remember there were times where I'm thinking, I have to follow me. I have to follow a version of myself. But it's flattering. There's a difference between being influenced and outright
stealing.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure that I've been influenced by comedians out there.
Oh, yeah. Everyone
you just have
is.
To guard against going too far with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I understand that you only go on tour. You don't like to perform close to home. Why is that?
I live in Las Vegas. My kids are in Las Vegas, and I like to wear the daddy hat when I'm in Las Vegas. And when I'm there, that's what I like to wrap my head around. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of places I can play on the road. So I like to get on a plane and go play show business. I'm in show business for a weekend, you know, whatever that is. And you deal with all of that. I'm not saying deal with it like it's negative, but I mean, that's just
– You keep it separate.
You're getting comps for people. You're getting backstage passes. You're doing that whole thing. But when I go home, I don't want that to be part of my world. I don't want to be dealing with people coming to town going, hey, can we get tickets for your show and all that sort of thing. It's like – No, I want to be with my kids.
The irony is that you live in Vegas, which is probably the best place to be a recognizable comedian. You could probably get a $50 million deal to headline at Caesars for 5 years if you wanted to.
Well, if I knew that was the case, I'd be dealing with the problems I was talking about.
Well, you've mostly stuck to stand-up throughout your career, and you haven't gone the usual route into movies and sitcoms until very recently. You're now starring in this show, Loudermilk. Was it an easy transition into acting for you?
Well, first of all, you say starring, and I have to have to quibble with that.
You're cast
in. I'm in it.
Okay.
I'm a cast member in it, and I'm happy to do that. And I also want to go back and correct something you said earlier.
Okay.
When you said that I had been on Letterman more than anybody.
That's what I had heard.
As a stand-up, I was on Letterman, I think, more than anybody after they moved to CBS.
Okay.
But the show went back to NBC. So the show was on for longer than when they moved to CBS.
Yeah.
Jake Johansson, who is an incredible comedian and an influence to so many, when you combine the two shows, did more than me. I think he had more appearances than anybody. Okay. And I just want to make sure that I'm
That's very
giving
humble
the right
of you.
Tip of the hat.
You don't have to do that. That's
No.
Cool,
I don't want to take something that I don't deserve. Jake Johansson is the top dog as far as that's concerned. So anyway, the Loudermilk thing. Peter Farrelly saw me perform and asked if I wanted to be in this show that he was directing and creating, and he also created it with Bobby Mort. And you know, I'm like, wow,
I can't do better than that.
You know what I mean? But the fact that he was even interested was pretty cool. Sometimes people say things like that and they never follow through.
Yeah,
he's one of these guys that actually every time he said he's going to call me, he did. Like he goes, "All right, I'll call you like in a few days," and then he called me. You're like, he's actually calling me, and so one thing led to another, which is a bit of mine, and I ended up in this show. You know, I have a small part in it, but it's been thrilling for me to try the acting thing, and I'm having fun with it.
Great. Well, in Nunchucks and Flamethrowers, you do a bit about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I think that you even performed in Israel just a few months ago.
Yes.
Before we go, I was wondering, did you do that bit when you were in the Middle East?
I did not, and it was a dilemma for me because that's a very good question, because I'm thinking the joke is about how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, maybe we should just have a good dad resolve it, because a good dad can solve a problem in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So I have this thing about, you know, let's send a good dad over there and go, what the hell is going on over here? Well, he started it. No, he started it. I don't care who started it. Knock it off. Why are you guys fighting anyway? Well, this is mine. No, it's mine. How about if it was neither of yours? Would you like that? No, how about if I took it away from both of you? Right, you don't like that, do you? Figure out how to share it. Say you love each other, get a good night's sleep. We're going to have a fantastic day tomorrow. So that's the bit.
Yeah.
And to me, I'm just sort of making a broad point about how complicated things, maybe an easier solution is the way to go at.
but I chose not to do it in Israel.
In Israel, because I didn't want to create anything bigger than I just wanted to go there to make people laugh.
Yeah.
But somebody asked me about it, because after our shows, we did a Q&A. And somebody said, you did a joke on The Tonight Show about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I noticed you didn't do it here tonight. You know, so I said, well, because I don't know if you looked around, but we're in Israel.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I chose to avoid it, but maybe that was chickening out. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably smart. The next day, there'd be some headline, you know, Brian Regan, Holocaust denier or something.
Right. So anyway, I just, at the time, I just sidestepped.
Wise move. Well, once again, Brian Regan's new stand-up special is called Nunchucks and Flamethrowers. It's available on Netflix November 21st. And where are you performing after that? Any dates that people should look for?
I don't have them in front of me.
I
have a, you know, you just go to BrianRegan.com and you'll see all the dates.
BrianRegan.com. Well, Brian, it was fun. Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, man. I had a good time.
Me too. Thanks again to Brian Regan for coming on the podcast. Watch his Netflix comedy special, Nunchucks and Flamethrowers, beginning November 21st. Follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Regan. And for more information, tour dates, and tickets to Brian's live shows, go to BrianRegan.com. Today's episode was sponsored by Nadex. You know, more investors are getting into day trading to take advantage of market downturns instead of watching helplessly from the sidelines. The problem? Day trading can be risky, and trading the downside can be confusing. But binary options on Nadex let you day trade with risk protection built in. You decide your maximum risk and reward, and you can never lose more. And trading downturns is just as easy as trading rallies. Try day trading for yourself on the first and largest American binary options exchange. Trade stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. That's Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.